You are listening to The Perks of Being a Book Lover, a show featuring two friends who've been in the same book club for almost 20 years.
I'm Carrie. My co-host Amy, unlike me, occasionally welcomes a little chaos into her life. In the last week, she has hosted a wonderful Irish meal for book club, which sort of exhausted her, and did some pet sitting of a potentially psycho dog.
That psycho dog is actually sitting on the bed right next to her recording right now. She looks very sweet at the moment. She's sleeping, but don't let that fool you. I'm Amy. My co-host Carrie loves a list, and she loves to cross things off that list and likes to stick to that list, even if it kills her.
Basically, we're opposites, but we find common ground on our shared love of books. Each week, we chat about what we're reading with each other and sometimes a special guest.
We also dabble in other topics like books in the news, recent book-inspired films, our TBR counts, and general things that tease our brains. Thanks for listening.
Jane Austen was born in 1775 and died in 1817, but she remains a writer who has captured the minds and hearts of many readers. The themes she addressed in her time remain ones that are relevant today: the need to be an individual despite the binds of society's rules, the complications of marriage, and the power and powerlessness that comes with changes in social class.
Our guests this week, Anne Kim and Melody Edwards, both love Jane Austen, and with such gusto that they wrote their own reimaginings of her novels. They talk about the potential pitfalls of their endeavors, given how exacting many Austen fans are, aka Austen fans are intense, man, as well as the things they wanted to ensure they kept from Austen versus the creative license they took to make their stories unique to their own experiences and modern times.
So listeners get a kind of a twofer today.
You do. But first, it's been almost 5 years since we started this podcast. Can you believe it, Carrie? Which means it also is close to our 5-year anniversary broadcasting on Forward Radio. From March 30th to April 13th, the station is having its annual pledge drive, so we'd like to ask you to support us by supporting them. Visit forwardradio.org to make a donation. What else is going on, Carrie?
I left the house this weekend.
You did. I did not, and you did. We've done a body switch.
Right, that's right.
You went to a play and had Prosecco and food, and
I did.
I stayed home and was antisocial.
Yes. I went to see with our mutual friend Bethany. We saw In Juliet's Garden, which is a play by Judy Elliott McDonald, and it was performed by the Women's Club of Louisville. And so Bethany had sent us the information a while back, and I was like, ooh, Shakespeare, I'll go. And so they had a really lovely reception prior to the show. I didn't know that was going to happen. And so they had Prosecco and tasty treats, and that was very nice. And then the show was good. And afterwards, it featured a Q&A, which I kind of think every show should do, except for maybe like the Broadway shows that end at 10:30. By that time, I'm like, I don't care. I want to go home. I don't know. Maybe we could figure out a way to start the shows at, I don't know, 3. Could we do that? I had read a book. I talked about it at some point this spring. Anyway, it was called Enter the Body by Joy McCullough. And it's about Shakespeare's heroines. And so when I saw that this play was being performed, and it's about Shakespeare's heroines and how they aren't really happy with Mr. S. They have some problems with how he wrote the plays and their roles in those plays. And so I thought this would be kind of interesting to compare and contrast. And it was. I had a very nice time, and it started at 2:30, and I was on my way to the grocery by 4. It was perfect. Perfect.
And so the book Enter the Body that you talked about several weeks ago on the show was kind of heavy and dark. It was like all the heroines who had been wronged by Shakespeare. So
yes.
Was this one any better?
I mean, well, it wasn't as bleak. Both of them featured Juliet and Ophelia. The Enter the Body also featured Cordelia and Lavinia. And In Juliet's Garden had Portia and Catherine from Taming of the Shrew. But they had a character who represents, so she's kind of like Shakespeare's agent. And so she comes to this meeting in the play, and I guess, as she said in the Q&A, she said, I'm sort of caught because while I'm a female and I understand where these female characters are coming from, I also represent Mr. S. And so I'm bound to sort of represent him in the best way possible and do what he wants me to do. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So yeah, the play was a much less heavy task, I guess. Yeah.
So is there a reason you're calling him Mr. S as opposed to Shakespeare?
They call him Mr. S in the play.
Okay.
So
okay.
Mr.
Okay.
S. So yeah, but it was good.
I was feeling a little under the weather this weekend. And my daughter brought over a psycho dog that she is dog sitting. She brought the dog over. I did not realize until she came was that her roommates really hate this little dog and kind of kicked her out of the house. Her name is Reese, and she is a Chihuahua miniature pincher mix. I sent you a picture of her, and you said, she's got crazy eyes.
She looks a little dead inside. I was like, she might murder you in your sleep.
No, although she's a more complicated dog than I am used to. Because I think she has it in her head that she can only like one person at a time. So when my daughter is around, she loves my daughter, follows my daughter everywhere. And if I try to get too close to her, she'll growl at me. Now, she's not going to bite me, but she's like most Chihuahuas or Chihuahua mixes where, you know, she mm-hmm. sounds like she's possessed, really, you know. But if my daughter is gone, then she'll follow me around and want on my lap and want my attention. So it's like she can only like one person at a time. None of my dogs are super crazy about her. The cat who my daughter has over here is not crazy about her. And my daughter had a full day of classes and work. And she said, could I just leave her over here and I'll be back tonight? Anyway, I am currently dog sitting.
And cat sitting.
And cat sitting. The crazy dog. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So that's what my last 2 days have been. Well, speaking of animals, I have a little news.
Yeah.
I have some bookish news that is not really news. It's more of just like a feel-good story that I saw and I forwarded it to you. Actually, I saw this on the BBC News, but it's about a library in the United States. There is a library in Massachusetts that is accepting pictures of cats in return for late or damaged books. The scheme is called Felines for Fee Forgiveness. It's at Worcester Public Library in Massachusetts, and they've had hundreds of items returned to them just days after it opened. And the goal is to get everyone back in the library and create a really low barrier to get fees forgiven. I just thought that was adorable. Although, why can't you have dogs too, or guinea pigs, or, you know, whatever you might have? Everybody just send a cute picture in and you get fee forgiveness.
Because you can't use the felines.
I guess.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could use canines for fee forgiveness, but it doesn't have the same ring.
It doesn't. You know, our library has no fees. And I think this is just another way for this library to do no fees, basically, and get some really cute cat pictures. Because honestly, I mean, what kind of person are you if a cute animal pet picture is not going to make you happy?
Yeah.
Just a little bit inside. You know, we've got several series we're watching, which we're still watching because they were many seasons long. And so we're not done with them. So, you know, we're watching 6 Feet Under and we're watching For All Mankind. I've talked about both of those on the show. But I was missing watching on occasion something a little lighter. And so we rediscovered a show that we used to love back in the 90s.
Oh, boy.
Northern Exposure. Did you ever watch Northern Exposure?
I did, very haphazardly. I wasn't a diehard, you know, I had to tune in every week.
So you can stream it on Amazon now. And I recognize all the characters. I'm like, oh, yes, I remember. And Marilyn, I love Marilyn, who's the Inuit receptionist. But I have a special fondness for that show as well, because the program that the doctor in Northern Exposure is doing, he's a doctor from New York City who, in order to get his medical school paid for, takes a job in what he thinks is Anchorage, Alaska. And when there are no spots available in Anchorage, once he gets there, they send him to this very rural place in Alaska called Sicily. which is not very big. I think it has like 500 people or something. And so Chris did the same program. The government paid for his medical school. And in turn, he worked in an underserved area, not in Alaska. He worked in Eastern Kentucky, in rural Kentucky. So anyway, when people would ask me about it, I would always say it's just like in Northern exposure. So
except no moose.
That's right. No moose. I have a special fondness for that show. We've watched a couple episodes and it's like, it's nostalgic. And I don't know, it kind of makes me feel good watching it.
Well, we restarted a series that is back now. That I think we've talked about, The Reluctant Traveler with Eugene Levy.
Oh, yeah. This has a second season. How
yeah,
is it?
It's pretty good. He's doing Europe this time. And so he visited Scotland, which, you know, we visited Scotland. So I was like, oh, that's so cool. And then the most recent one, he visited Germany, which we're hoping to take our kids to Germany in 2 years. So we were pretty excited, you know, to see that. So
I heard him interviewed about the new season and about the Scotland one, because apparently his mother is from Scotland.
Yeah, she was born there.
Yeah, and grew up in sort of a tenement type situation in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that was kind of interesting to me, because I never would have necessarily thought that his mother was Scottish.
Yeah, so it's fun. I mean, I kind of wish in some way, you know, because he's always staying in these very lavish places.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, it would be a lot more fun if he was staying in like a regular place. I don't know. I think those would kind of lend more humor potentially to it. But it's also kind of like, well, you know, this is, I guess, our version of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous or something like that. So
I agree. And maybe that's the only way they could get him to do it.
Maybe.
Since he is a reluctant traveler.
Maybe. It's like, I have to be in this really, really, really nice place.
You know, it would be funny if he had to stay in an Airbnb where you're like, I wonder how I get the dishwasher to work.
Right.
And or, I can't get the shower to turn on.
Right. Why isn't this fan operational? We had that issue.
Yeah.
I'm pushing the button. It won't work. What is wrong? Yeah.
Yeah, that would be funnier, but, you know, maybe they're just not paying him enough to
do that. And he's like, if I'm going to do this, y'all have to ante up and pay for these swanky locations.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to give another reminder to people that, hey, I am available for book recommendations. The book recommender is in.
So Lucy, with your sign outside your little cardboard.
You know, in the past couple months, I have given 4 or 5 book recommendations to listeners who have wanted one. And I don't know, I think some of them have been successful. People would have to write back and tell me. A couple people have. But I am ready to do more. So if you need a book that you think would be good for your book club, if you're looking for a bookish gift for that person in your life, or you just want to task me and see if I can come up with something for some, you know, very niche topic, send me in your questions. And you can go to our website, click the contact button to reach us, or you can message us on our socials on Instagram and on Facebook.
You know, Amy, what you don't have to give a recommendation for?
What's that?
You don't have to give a recommendation for Austin Reimagining.
That's because
we're bringing 2 to listeners today. Here you go. 2 awesome reimaginings, retellings, homages, whatever you want to call them. Are you ready to talk to Anne and Melody?
I'm ready.
When Amy and I were first contacted about these authors, we knew that we had to have both of them on at the same time, because both have either recently published or will soon publish novels written in the vein of Jane Austen. Relative Strangers by A.H. Kim is a spin on Sense and Sensibility and will be published in April 2024, while Once Persuaded, Twice Shy by Melody Edwards is a reimagining of Persuasion, which came out in February 2024. Anne and Melody, we're so glad to have both of you. Welcome.
Thank you so much
for having us on.
So I want to know from both of you, you know, for so many people, Jane Austen is like the epitome of the reading experience for them. There's so many Austenites, right? So I'm curious, what was your most memorable experience with reading or watching adaptations of Jane Austen? Where did you start with your love of Austen literature?
Well, that's a tough one because it's so ongoing for so much of your life. You're like, where did this start? Probably the 1995 Pride and Prejudice. One of my older sisters had been reading Pride and Prejudice and I had picked it up and I think I was 9 or 10 at the time. So it was a struggle with the language, but from what I could get of the plot, I was really enjoying it. And then they put on the Colin Firth, Jennifer Ely, and we sat down and did, you know, was it all 6 hours of that? And at the end of that, that's it. I was an Austen fan. And then I tore through all the other books. And then I was devastated when I got to the end of number 6, went, what do you mean she died? And there's no more books. And that was just, you know, devastating to me as a kid writing a lot of YA where the authors are perpetually giving you new series and new copies, to just find out that that was finite from several hundred years ago.
So did you read then some like Austen retellings? Was that something that you did, you know, to fill that void that you had?
Well, I went deep dive into Jane Austen herself. I read the letters and the biographies. And, you know, when I was 16, I got to go to England and visit Bath and see the little blue plaque on her house and sort of did that whole pilgrimage. I have read some retellings. I enjoy them very much. I've not read as many of them as I'd like, but things like P.D. James's Death Comes to Pemberley, where Elizabeth has to solve a crime. I love that. It's brilliant.
How about you, Anne?
Funny that 1995 seems to have been a big year for both me and Melody. I wasn't one of those girls who read a lot of Jane Austen growing up. And I think partly it's because I had an older brother. So I read whatever he was reading. So he read a lot of Dickens, a lot of John Irving, you know, a lot of, you know, male authors. And as soon as he put those books down, I picked them up and started reading them myself. But he was never reading any Jane Austen. So I didn't grow up reading Jane Austen. And then it was probably around 1995 when I saw the Emma Thompson Ang Lee version of Sense and Sensibility. That just became my comfort movie. I just loved every single second of it. I loved the soundtrack. I loved the editing. I loved the scenery. And so from that became sort of my gateway drug to Austen. So not only other movies, versions of Austen, but of course the books themselves. And the thing about the books is once you get sort of used to the cadence of the writing, they're hilarious. I feel like Jane Austen invented snark. She's got such great snarky comments, especially in Sense and Sensibility. And so, yes, I then swallowed up all of the Jane Austen books. And I'm a big fan as well of the various retellings. And the great thing about that is there are endless retellings, and endless retellings being issued, you know, like in this case, every month. So I'm glad that we don't have any shortage of Austen books to read.
So Melody, you love Austen, but I mean, not everybody who loves Austen is going to say, I think I'm going to write a novel. You know, I'm going to write a reimagining or a retelling. So what was it that made you decide to do that, a book inspired by Jane?
Well, it sort of fell into it by accident. So I wrote my first book, which was a modern retelling of Jane Eyre. So I did an English literature degree at the University of Toronto, but then I went into communications in the financial sector. And I just encountered a particular setting that I thought would be a perfect place for modern Jane Eyre. And so I wrote that. And that went okay. And so that got me my agent and my editor, who's lovely, Kate Seaver over at Berkeley. And she said, right, how about a second book? What about another retelling? And so I kind of went to my bookshelf and said, who wants to play? And I looked at, you know, Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South and some of those novels. But really, Austen's the first love. Everybody does love Austen. And Persuasion is my absolute favorite Austen. So I really wanted to tackle that. And I thought it'd be a nice challenge, because so much of the novel is two people in love who don't want to look at each other and don't want to talk to each other. And that works in Austen's time when you have such restrictive social etiquette. But in modern times, I mean, why wouldn't you have social media stalked them or just approached them at a party or called them up, texted them, etc.? So the challenge of trying to keep them at arm's length, keep them together, but keep them apart through a whole modern novel, I thought would be fun. And so I thought I'd take that on.
Persuasion happens to be my favorite Austen book as well. And Anne was saying they're just so funny, like with the snark. And I noticed that you took some comedy writing classes at Second City. at one point. Did that help you in writing your retelling?
Yeah, Anne's right. Jane Austen is the snarkiest, and I love reading her letters because she doesn't hold back less than in her novels. It helped me a bit, yeah. I took those classes a while back, and they oddly helped me with my communications career because I did a lot of writing for that. You wouldn't think they do, but they do. And it's very much about examining what's the funny, particularly in dialogue, and just how you structure that. So when I went to write Persuasion, which is one of Austen's, I think, it's very funny, but it is one of her more angst-filled and serious novels because it's towards the end of her life. She was ill when she was writing it. And of course, it's second chance romance. It's lost love. It's a heroine who's older. So I wanted to find a way to delicately insert some of that humor and try to mimic some of Austen's snark, which is really quite a unique fingerprint in her own writing.
So Anne, how about you? What led to your decision to write a spin on an Austen story?
So, like I said, the Ang Lee, Emma Thompson version of the movie of Sense and Sensibility was my comfort watch. And so I had written a young adult novel, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, in the hopes of being published. Went into the querying trenches, sent out countless queries, got, you know, rejections or no answers. My ego was bruised. After about a year or two, I said, okay, well, I'm going to move on. I'm going to write another novel. And I did. And it was a manuscript that ultimately turned it into my debut novel, A Good Family. But at that point, I was querying. I was still getting no answers. I was feeling extra, extra bruised. And so, you know, you can imagine the movie version of my life. I'm sitting on the couch, wallowing in my misery, eating a pint of Ben and Jerry's, watching my comfort movie. And I thought, you know, everybody says that while you're waiting to hear back from agents, you should just go ahead and write your next book. And I thought, well, what am I going to write? You know, then there's that moment where I look up at the screen and I don't remember, Emma Thompson is looking at Hugh Grant or whatever. And I was like, oh, I want to write this story. But, you know, my goal always is to sort of reflect the Asian American experience, my experience. So I thought, oh, I'll write a modern day Sense and Sensibility, but tell it from the perspective of two Korean American sisters.
I'm wondering about, you know, you talk about angst and the angst of either her books or Anne when you were waiting to hear back. And I'm wondering about the angst that may have gone into writing your stories, because I would imagine, or at least for me, I would feel a certain amount of pressure, right? Because people do love Austen. And when they love her hard. And so did that feel intimidating? You know, did you have friends who love Austen, read it as you were working on it? What were your feelings about that? And for each of you, what were the challenges of sort of bringing it into the modern world?
So I will read the first line of my acknowledgement section. It says, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that no writer should tread into Jane Austen territory and expect to emerge unscathed." So I know, yes, you are absolutely right. Jane Austen fans are fans through and through. They know every line, every, you know, character, every scene. And so it is really hard territory to tread into without, you know, fear of stepping on a landmine. So I don't know. I use different words for the book. Sometimes I say retelling. Sometimes I say homage. Sometimes I say nod to. I don't know what the right word is because it's not obviously a beat by beat retelling of the story, but it's the characters, it's the emotions, it's the tensions that I get from the book told through a modern lens. Mm-hmm. So from that, I felt like, you know, Jane felt so constrained in her own life. I think she would be generous to others and say, don't feel constrained by me. You know, feel inspired, but don't feel constrained. So from that, I felt some degree of freedom. And then in terms of the setting of the book itself, I take my characters and instead of the cottage in the countryside where the Dashwood sisters go, I send my sisters off to a cancer retreat center in Northern California, which is based on an actual cancer retreat center that I've been to. And the thing about that place is There is no Wi-Fi. There are no TVs. I don't even remember if we had landline phones. So you really are cut off from the world. And I like that about the setting, because then you can kind of imagine yourself in a different time when you don't have constant Instagram and pings on your phone. So I try to take that flavor of the olden days by removing my characters from the modern world.
What elements of the original story were important to you to keep in your version to stay true to what you liked about the original?
Well, for me, what I love, I think what really resonated with me was the relationship between the two sisters, with Eleanor and Marianne. And I have a sister, and I am the older sister. I am the Eleanor in the family, the responsible, tempered, you know, motherly sister. And my younger sister is the more devil-may-care, adventurous one. So it was fun to not only take that relationship that's in the book, but also take little pieces of the relationship that I have with my sister and to kind of play with that and riff on it a little bit. Those are some things that I really wanted to play on. I also love wordplay. And Melody, I love it that you studied at Second City, because humor is a huge thing in my life. I mean, I think I value humor almost as highly as kindness in people. And so I like to throw in all these little Easter eggs and inside jokes and movie allusions. So there are lots of little things in the book that hopefully my family or friends will get, and they'd be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe she put that in there. Those are my little gifts to my friends. But also, like, if you're a big movie buff, I think many of my friends who are movie buffs have said, I loved all the movie allusions because I love kind of being in on the in joke.
I like that Anne said stumbling over the word retelling, because I had the same issue. I'm not going beat for beat, but anyone who reads this is going to know where the source material comes from. And we eventually settled on, my editor settled on the word reimaginings, which I quite like.
Yeah.
But for tackling Austin, yeah, it's tough because the Austin fans are fans through and through. And for a lot of people who know the Netflix Persuasion that came out in 2022, oh my goodness, released the Kraken. It got roasted and people went to the mat to defend it and attack it. And I was like, what have I done? What have I entered into? But for me, it's just a matter of, I am one of the crazy rabid fans. So you just approach it with so much love and so much joy in the source material. And just know that the reason it's so brilliant these materials go forward is because they're so psychologically deep and they're so intricate that it gives rise to this level of fandom and this level of debate. I mean, I can remember having arguments with classmates in my undergrad about whether Anne was really right to break up with Wentworth the first time. And I mean, that conversation could have gone for hours. So knowing that it's there for that level of scrutiny is I think, okay. And that people are going to come up against it, maybe not like your version or love your version or see what you see in the characters. But, you know, I always say I could do endless numbers of variations off the same Austin story. Like I did Anne Elliot as a town counselor and an executive director of a theater company, but I could have also done Anne Elliot, the emergency room nurse. And that would have made sense to me as well in a modern retelling. So just know that there's infinite spinoffs of it, really, and have fun with the one that you're doing.
Yeah. So what elements were important to you to keep in it?
Yeah, Anne's right. The relationships are absolutely critical. The relationships in the comedy. And everyone loves comedy till you have to write it. And then it gets so tough. Back when it was my Second City courses, and you know, we'd have things like, okay, you're going to write a 5-minute sketch and you need something funny every third line after the first 20-second mark. And then it's like, oh my goodness, this is so stressful. But it was a great time. The relationships are important. For me, the psychology of the heroine is important. So when I go to plot out one of my reimaginings, I've done two now, is I look at the seminal events that happen in the novel that affect character development. So in Persuasion, something like Louisa Musgrove's fall in Lyme that, you know, sends Anne into triage mode and has Wentworth frozen and suddenly appreciating the competence and the abilities of Anne. So I look for moments like that. And then in my notebook, I honestly just draw a dotted line across the other side of the notebook. And then I write what my modern equivalent was going to be. And I just, as much as possible, try to capture the essence of the heroine. And everything else, you know, the side characters and the landscapes and the settings, that's there for the playing with. But I figure as long as I've got Anne Elliot, then I'll be okay.
So I have to ask, what did you think of that version of Persuasion? Carrie and I saw it together. Boy. So you probably don't want to say it on air, maybe, worried that you'll get, you know.
I'll get roasted. You know, I have an article coming out with another publication that's going through all the Persuasion adaptations. So I figure I'm subjecting myself to this anyways. I think the 2007 ITV Persuasion is my favorite Persuasion. Beautiful settings, beautiful cinematography, haunting music, fantastic acting. It's all great. 1995, probably most faithful to the actual book. And the 90s really were a banner year for Austen adaptations. We've got Sense and Sensibility, which I also love. We've got The Pride and Prejudice. We've got The Emma with Gwyneth Paltrow. We've got The Persuasion with Amanda Root. It's just really good times. I saw the 2022 Netflix one. I thought there were some things they did very well. I thought the costumes and the production quality were great. I thought Richard Grant as her father was amazing, and Henry Golding as the flirtatious Mr. Elliot was also amazing. The only thing I would really take issue with is, again, I feel they've lost the character Van. I feel they took the character of that TV show Fleabag, who's kind of fun and crass and drinking and fourth wall breaks, and they put that in the middle of Persuasion, which breaks my heart a little bit, because I'm like, that's not the character of Anne that we follow along with so closely. But I think there are still things to love in it.
Okay, that was very diplomatic. That was very diplomatic.
Nobody can say anything
I just
about that.
Danced around that answer for about 20 minutes, didn't I?
Okay, well, I want to know, Melody, so with your setting, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, I think, but the setting of your story is in Niagara-on-the-Lake. Which is a beautiful, I mean, it's close to the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. I have visited there and I was so excited that the setting was there because it is one of my favorite places that I've ever visited. So why did you decide to set it there? Talk to us a little bit about that setting and what that added to your story.
Yeah, I'm so glad you've been there. It's so stunning and it's so hard to describe for people who haven't been there. Canadian settings are important to me. My first novel, I set in the financial district of Toronto. It's our version of Wall Street. Ours is called Bay Street. I worked there for 12 years. And it's really funny because when I first went out with the novel, I thought they'd ask me to change it to something more recognizable. And they actually really liked the Canadian setting. So the second novel, they said, give us another unique Canadian setting. And I've been going to Niagara-on-the-Lake since I was a kid. And I just adore it. So I really want to do that. I really want to do a book in autumn, and it's just stunning in autumn. It's close to the borders you mentioned, so American readers can come and visit, and I would encourage people to do that. It's just great. But really what it was it gave me a number of settings in one. So you've got hiking trails, you've got small towns and farms, but you've also got a historic little main street, and you've got a historic fort with reenactments like Colonial Williamsburg. You've got luxury hotels and spas and golf courses. So I thought there's so many settings to cycle through, because the original Persuasion, she's moving from Kellynch Estate in the country to her sister's estate, to Lyme, to Bath. You know, there's a lot of movement. And there's also a lot of activity. And again, I go back to the root problem of you have two lovers who are refusing to interact. So not only do I need them in a very close forced proximity setting, I need a lot of activity and a lot of changes of setting to keep it engaging and to keep coming up with reasons for why they'd not only be thrown together, but that they'd be interrupted as well. And so I thought, if I've got this small town setting that is so much crammed into it, and it's so beautiful and so romantic, then I can keep them spinning for a long time.
Hmm. Well, you did it very successfully. I just finished it today. It was a really fun read. Now, Anne, I want to know about yours, because yours is a little unique in that in your version, your sisters, like the Dashwoods, but you're working in Korean culture into it. And so how did you work that in?
I guess I might disagree somewhat with the question, because I'm not sure that I work Korean culture into the story. And so I don't know if you've seen the movie American Fiction.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, it was so good. It was so good on so many different levels. But there's a scene, and it's not a spoiler because it's in all the trailers, where he goes to the bookstore looking for his books. And honestly, as authors, don't we all? And he asks the poor book clerk, where are my books? And the guy looks it up and he says, oh, here they are. And they're under the African American Studies section. And his books, he says, you know, the only thing black about my books is the ink on the page. Because he doesn't write about African American studies or African American culture. He writes pretty academic, dry books. And so in that way, I sometimes feel like people expect my books to be Korean books or about the Asian American experience. And they are about the Asian American experience, but I think it's important to remember the American part. So I moved here when I was a baby, and I've been back to Korea a couple of times, but I don't speak the language. I'm not comfortable or whatever, natural in the culture. So in my books, it's really more of a focus on being Asian American or Korean American. In this particular story, it's about also being mixed race. So the father is Korean, the mother is, you know, white or American. And my children are mixed race as well. So some of the tensions of that, you know, people asking, what are you? You know, which is a really rude question to ask. I'm human. I'm a human being. Or a friend saying, like, you're not Asian enough when you're half Asian. So there are scenes like that where the main character, Amelia, remembers, you know, going to a bar and saying, Asian women age well. And her friends say, like, you're only half Asian. So, you know, there's another scene where she smells her armpits. And she says, oh, thank goodness I inherited my dad's Korean no-smell genes. So this is a little known fact about Korean people, but they don't use deodorant because they don't have BO.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I know. I know. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on a but it's, again, it's like a little known fact that. But, you know, it's something that I thought would be fun to insert. So I have a lot of little nods to Korean American or Asian American culture, but it's not necessarily about being Korean, right, or about being the trials and tribulations of being Korean.
Well, I'm wondering, and in the story with the brother who was born in Korea, I'm wondering, so, you know, that brings in this complication that they discover that they have this brother. So I guess I'm thinking about some of the laws and things that might have been done in Korea versus the United States. Is that based in fact, or is that, I mean, I just kind of assumed, I was like, oh, that sounds like it would be legitimate. You know, I mean, it was very believable to me. Did you have to study and look up what the laws are?
Right. That's such a perfect question, because I'm actually writing an article, just like Melody wrote an article. I'm writing an article about basically how to write law into fiction. The thing about law, like medicine, is that, you know, you go to medical school or law school and you learn sort of the generic parts of those professions. But then to actually be able to practice, you have to specialize in something. So as a lawyer, I specialized in utility law, which is, you know, super, super specialized. So my first book was about whistleblowers and white collar crime, which I knew nothing about. So I had to research it for the book. And similarly, for this book, there's inheritance law, you know, there's choice of law. Do you use Korean law or US law, depending on the case? There were a number of different legal issues that I had to research. Hmm. And, you know, there's a kind of a limit to how much detail you really want to put in a book. I mean, you don't want to bore people with all this. Like,
right, right.
Know, according to this decision, this happened. Yeah, according to that law, this is the outcome. And so, you know, I kind of fudged some of the little details. I have my own explanations for why certain things happened, but I could see, you know, an inheritance law specialist coming in and saying, like, well, actually, under the laws of California where they reside, you know, but I felt like I could take some liberties with the actual details of.
Yeah. Well, it worked. I was like, yep, sounds right. Let's keep going with the story. Sounds good. Believable.
And that's exactly the gist of the article that I'm writing, which is like, really, you don't have to get everything 100% right. As long as it passes the laugh test, you're doing fine.
All right.
So Melody, you mentioned that you wrote a modern update to Jane Eyre titled Jane and Edward. And then, you know, you've done this one, which is an Austen retelling. So how is this similar or not to the experience of writing your first one?
Well, similar in that my translation of what happened in the original book to what I need to happen in a modern equivalent, that process was the same. I probably did more planning on the second one because I was really learning on the first one. I'm like, oh, now I know it's an issue if I have 5 Mondays in a row by accident. So let's plot out our timelines here. So that one a little bit better. But it was very, very different in that the Bronte material and the Austen material are different in their tone, in their content. Their writing style is different. Bronte is very dark and epic and high emotionality, whereas Austen is, you know, very sophisticated and sparkling. And I don't want to say light as in lacking substance. I just mean it's charming and it's funny. So I've heard someone describe it, you know, Bronte's our whiskey and Austen is champagne. Mm-hmm. And that kind of feels like the right difference. So when I was writing the first one, I really leaned hard into the hard emotions, the despair and the highs of being in love and stuff. And then when you go into Persuasion, it's a more mature heroine. She's looking back on her life. It's more sophisticated. So I tried to make her more introspective without ever making it drag on too long. So there's a lot of questions about how she ended up in this place in her life where her family takes advantage of her and the love of her life is courting someone else and then have her work from there. So I've already had some early readers who are like, this is very different from your first one. I'm like, well, I'm mimicking a different author this time. So whether you like a Bronte or an Austen, hopefully you'll find the corresponding thing in the book.
Well, certainly, I mean, Jane Eyre is much more angsty, and you're right. I mean, she's young, and maybe that's, you know, part of it, where Anne is a more mature person. And I mean, she has some anxiety about things, but I don't know that I would call it angst. So I bet in some ways it was maybe a little lighter. When I say lighter, I mean, I don't want to say more fun, but a lighter experience, I should say, writing the Austen, the newest one.
And yeah, you're right. Jane Eyre's younger. She comes from a place of poverty and loneliness, and she lacks resources. And, you know, keeping a roof over her head is as great a consideration as romance in her life. You're kind of at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy there for your needs. But Anne Elliot's got, even though her family's appalling and they're rapidly losing money, she still comes from a place of luxury and ease and wealth. And there were other suitors in her life, et cetera, et cetera. So more fun. Yeah, probably more fun to write. I felt more like I was writing dance choreography in, again, that I needed to keep interrupting her in Wentworth. And I needed these other characters to be waltzing in and out of my scenes, where with Jane Eyre, it's really her and Rochester alone in a tower sort of a deal. So it's very intense one-on-one. So there's a lot of subtext, whereas in my Jane Austen retelling, there's just a lot of text.
I mean, until you said that, I had never really differentiated Bronte and Austen in that way, but it's so true. Like Wuthering Heights, they're all so like high drama, you know, very romance with a capital R and big, and with Austen, it's manners. Like, you know, her stories, a lot of them are its manners. And I had never really put that together. But I have to say, if we're going to have a battle between Bronte and Austen, I'm team Bronte. I know I feel like
that's,
I should.
That's all right.
Leave
There's
the
room,
room
for both. But, you know, yeah. One writing, let the other write, really. All the female writers that came before, whatever doors they kicked down and whatever styles they learned, they led the way for more female writers to keep building the canon for the rest of us to now shamelessly pillage for our own retellings.
Well, Anne, you mentioned your first book, A Good Family, and it's not a reimagining or retelling. It's a contemporary novel about a family that sort of implodes under the weight of secrets. So I'm wondering, what did you learn from the experience of writing about that family that you applied to Relative Strangers?
Well, it's funny that you paired me up with Melody, because I feel like every time I have an answer, she sort of echoes it. And every time she has an answer, I'm like, yes, exactly. So readers of A Good Family who have read the advanced copies of Relative Strangers say, oh, wow, these books are really different. A Good Family was dark. You know, it was told from two perspectives. It was, you know, snarky in kind of a not kind way. And I think some people might say, you know, none of the characters were particularly likable. Whereas I think with Relative Strangers, it's a much lighter, champagne-y kind of book. I think all of the characters are likable in their own way. And, you know, there's snark in it, but it's very like gentle, sweet snark. So I think the colors of the book are very different. I did learn a lot from writing that book. And as I said earlier, I had written this YA book that kind of went nowhere. And I know now why it went nowhere, because it had no plot. And, you know, so It's good to have a plot. So my second book, or, you know, my second book, but my first published book, A Good Family, had a lot of plot in it, but it took forever for that plot to actually kind of form, because I had to learn from trial and error. You know, as I was sending out queries to agents, I kept making it stronger and stronger. Once I got my agent, he worked with me for a full year to make it strong enough to send out on submission. So I learned a lot sort of on the job with A Good Family. And then when I was set forth on writing Relative Strangers, I think I kind of had the benefit of all those lessons. Plus, I had the benefit of one of the greatest authors ever, Jane Austen. She gave me the story, right? So I kind of knew what the climax or what the citing incident or all those kinds of things were, because they were already in the original. And I just kind of needed to try to imagine what my modernized version of that climax or that pivot point would be. So yes, I was lucky to have a great, great teacher or model in the original author.
Well, like I said, when we saw both your books and we were like, okay, we want to read these. And then when we read them, we were like, we can't choose. We can't choose between these two authors. We have to have both of them on. So we're really glad that both of you have been able to chat with us. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're all going to share what we're reading.
But before we talk about what we're reading, we are going to hear from a fellow book lover who's going to tell us about her most recent 5-star read.
Hey, my name is Brianna Wright. I live in Northwest Alabama, and I'm here today to tell you about my last 5-star read. I wanted to talk about Long Live by V.B. Lacey. This book is actually the first in the Elementals of Iona duology. And it was a debut, and I was kicking my feet. I was laughing aloud. I was chewing my nails, and I was literally wishing some of the characters would die. I've always said that if a book makes me feel something, it's a good book, whether those are positive feelings or negative feelings. And so this book really, it had me feeling lots of feelings. It's a romanticy, which I love, and the ending of this book is literally the cliffhanger of all cliffhangers. You will want to read book two immediately, as you will be desperate for answers. Also, reading this one, I highlighted a lot. The writing was just so beautiful, so swoon-worthy in several places. So yes, check it out. Long Live by V.B. Lacey.
We are back with our Austen retelling authors. We have Anne Kim and Melody Edwards here with us, and Carrie. So Carrie, you have lots of books on your nightstand. You refuse to buy any more. So I want to know which of that big stack you were reading right now.
Well, I did actually finish one that I don't know where I got it. It didn't even have the cover, like the nice paper, pretty cover. So
you got it at a used book sale then, maybe.
Maybe, or maybe from a little library. I'm not sure. Anyway, this is a book that I have wanted to read for a while. It's Deacon King Kong by James McBride. So it was on my shelf. I'm like, I'm going to tackle it. So this story, it's set in Brooklyn, New York in the late 1960s. And there is a whole cast of unusual characters with amazing names who sort of weave in and out of the story. So probably the main character of the story is named Sportcoat. He's an old man who does odd jobs and wants to get a youth baseball team back together, because his mentee, whose name is Deems, is now a drug dealer. Sportcoat is hoping that a return to baseball will set Deems straight again. But this plan goes all to heck because Sportcoat spends a lot of his time drunk, and he actually shoots Deems. Deems is not killed, fortunately, but you know, he's not real happy with Sportcoat and is probably not going to want to join a baseball team after being shot. Then there's also the elephant, whose real name is Tommy Elefante, and he is an Italian smuggler who inherited his job from his father, and he would really just like to own a little shop and settle down with a nice girl. But he's in this sort of criminal smuggling business. So despite seeming completely unconnected, as the story progresses, the reader discovers that there's a connection between the elephant and Sport Coat's deceased wife, Hattie, that shows that there are people who can be trusted, even if they aren't always good. So I really love the story. The characters were deep, but they were also funny. And I mean, the names, there's one character named Sausage, Hot Sausage. And
oh,
I'm like,
goodness.
How can you not like a book that has a character named Sport Coat, the elephant, and Hot Sausage? You can't go wrong.
Those are great names. Those are great nicknames.
So that is Deacon King Kong. And if you read the book, you will find out what the Deacon, the King, and the Kong refer to. So Deacon King Kong by James McBride. All right. Anne, you want to tell us what you've been reading?
Oh my goodness, how do I follow that? Now, at any time, I usually have at least two books that I'm working on. Usually one on audio that I listen to while I walk and while I cook, and then one that I read in hard copy at my nightstand. So the one that's on my iPhone right now that I'm listening to is Hello Beautiful by Anne Napolitano, famous for Dear Edward. And I'm not quite sure how to describe it other than maybe like Little Woman in modern day Chicago. It's the story of these four sisters, and each one has, you know, their unique gifts and quirks. And I don't want to, you know, spoil it, but basically a huge rift happens in the family, and one of the sisters goes off and raises her daughter by herself, and then at the end comes together. So it's kind of a slow burn story for me, but I'm really enjoying it. And I'm at 94% right now. So I can't wait to hear how it wraps up. On my nightstand, I have Every Time We Say Goodbye by Natalie Jenner, who wrote The Jane Austen Society and Bloomsbury Girls. So this is like the third part of that trilogy. Natalie is a good friend of mine. We both debuted in 2020, and she's gone on to become an international bestselling author. And she is a Jane Austen expert. So I was a little trepidatious when I shared Relative Strangers with her, but she loved it and blurbed the book. So I'm so grateful to her. And then next up on my nightstand is The Fetishist by Catherine Min. And I haven't opened the book yet, but the story of the story is fascinating in that Catherine Min had published her debut novel, you know, over a decade ago, which did very well. She was working on her second novel when she got very sick with breast cancer and ended up passing away. After she passed away, her daughter, Kayla Min Andrews, who I actually just met at a conference recently, picked up the manuscript and took it to an agent and said, I think we need to work on this and publish it. So she got an agent, she got an editor, and it just published earlier this month to rave reviews. So I'm super excited to read it. And I think what a wonderful tribute from a daughter to her mother.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Well, I have a question about the first book, Hello Beautiful. You said you listened to it on audiobook, and I am super picky about my audiobooks. It has to be super engaging or I lose focus with my audiobook. So how would you rate the narration on it?
I would say it's probably a 9 out of 10.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm a pretty tough judge on audiobooks because I agree the narrator makes a huge difference. Sometimes there are certain books that I can't even listen to because the narrator drives me up the wall.
Yes.
But the narrator on this one is excellent.
Okay. Good to know. I'll add it to my audiobook TBR then.
All right. Well, Melody, what have you been up to in terms of reading?
I am reading right now something called Murder Your Employer, The Master's Guide to Homicide by Rupert Holmes. And
I saw this one out and it was the title is intriguing.
Isn't the title gorgeous? I just saw the cover of the book and it said Murder Your Employer, The Guide to Homicide. And I'm like, yes, I will pick that up. Not that I want to murder my employer, but I was intrigued by the concept. And it is such tremendous fun. It's like a murder mystery with a high body count, which is the kind I like. But it kind of comes at it from this backwards approach in that it's a bunch of people who, for very legitimate reasons, want to murder somebody in their life. and they get all get tapped to go to this special academy. And the special academy teaches you how to murder people. So there's a class on poisons, there's a class on alibis, and it goes on and on. It's this very special campus, and you're tasked with your thesis, and your thesis that you have to have planned out by the end of your time at the academy is the murder of this person in your life. And then you're graduated to go on and murder them. But because everyone's murderous, of course, they're having, you know, not so accidental accidents between the students and the professors and things like that. So it's really alarmingly funny and very, very dark. And fun bit of trivia, Rupert Holmes, which I think was his pseudonym, is the fellow who wrote the Pina Colada song.
Oh my gosh. Weird.
For weirdness just gonna abound. Add that. So it's someone who can write Pina Colada song and then go write a murder mystery. And It sounds weird, but when you mash those things together, that is what this book feels like. So I'm having such writer's envy over it, actually, because it's so fun and it's full of the snark, as we were discussing about Jane Austen. So yeah, that's what I'm reading right now. And I've got a bookmark in it because I launched my book in a week. So I've got a to-do list with my publicist that I haven't gotten on. And then I very much hope to return to it.
Oh, that one sounds really good.
This is one of my favorite things is when we have guests and we get to find out what they're reading, because I'm just like, oh, these sound so good. They always sound so good. All right. Well, Amy, you're last up. What have you been reading?
I read a book recently by audiobook called The Mostly True Story of Tanner and Louise by Colleen Oakley. And so if you like a road trip story, this book is for you. If you like a multi-generational story between a senior citizen and a young person, this will be right up your alley. So imagine the movie Thelma and Louise, except for instead of two runaway 40-something women, you have a college-aged woman named Tanner and an 80-year-old woman named Louise. Tanner has had to come home from college because she lost her sports scholarship after injuring herself. Her parents can't afford to send her back without the scholarship. But at home, she is bitter and childish, and she's treating her mother like a servant. And so her mother has sort of had it with her. And she's made herself such a pain in the butt to her family that her mother tells her that she needs to go find somewhere else to live. So Tanner reluctantly moves in with Louise, being her driver and a pseudo caretaker after a hip replacement. But it turns out that Louise has a 50-year-old secret that has caught up with her, and she has to make it to California to see her friend George before it's too late. So she offers to pay Tanner's tuition for her next college semester if she agrees to drive her from Atlanta to California in her lime green convertible sports car. And you can imagine that hijinks ensue. So I adored this book. I could relate to both characters because I have a 20-something-year-old daughter, and I'm also dealing with both my husband and my aging parents. Tanner and Louise seem like they don't have anything in common because Tanner is risk-averse, and Louise has a wild streak. She doesn't mind breaking some rules. And you get the sense that in the beginning, they don't particularly like each other. But as the story progresses, they develop this mutual respect for one another that's really heartwarming. And it is super funny. So I listened to this on audiobook. I highly recommend it. The narrator is Hilary Huber. And this would be the perfect book to listen to in the car or on a plane while you're traveling yourself on your summer travels or spring break or what have you. It was just a really fun, good time. So again, the name of that book is The Mostly True Story of Tanner and Louise by Colleen Oakley.
Very good. Well, we want to thank our guests again. Relative Strangers by A.H. Kim is coming out in April 2024. And Once Persuaded, Twice Shy by Melody Edwards was published in February 2024. If you are looking for some unique reimaginings, retellings, homages, whatever you want to call it, check out both of these books. Ladies, thanks again for being our guest. It's been a delight chatting with you both.
Thank you so much. This was super fun.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having us on.
You can find this week's Austen authors at their website, Anne Kim at www.ahkim.net and Melody Edwards at melodyedwards.com. They're also on Instagram at Melody Writes Edwards and at ahkim.writer.
For show notes for any episode, visit our website at perksofbeingabooklover.com. We're also on Instagram at perksofbeingabooklover pod and on Facebook at perksofbeingabooklover. To send us a message, go to our website and click the contact button.
If you enjoy listening to us each week, tell a friend, write us a review on your favorite podcast platform to help other book lovers find us.
And finally, a huge thank you to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, a grassroots community radio station in Louisville, Kentucky. You can find our show there, live or in archives, at forwardradio.org.